Right. What are we talking about?
Kindness. You're doing the intro.
Can you move those cups out of that?
Are you?
Well, if I could drink my tea.
What's wrong with it?
It's 1,000 degrees.
That's what happens to tea.
Do I sound ungrateful?
Are you right?
Yeah, I just forgot where my mouth was.
Awkward. Do you want a straw for your coffee?
Do you want me to count you in?
Oh, can you like that? Here.
Oh, your voice is very official when you... I feel like a change in my mind when you start talking and I'm scared. It scares me. I don't like it.
What is... This is not a clapperboard. This is... Put it in front of the thing.
Yeah, do it. Then I can scene. And then you're like, line.
Line.
Oh, that was very loud. Sorry.
Thank you.
It just... Yeah. Good.
I think Lou should do the introduction.
No. You do the introduction and then let segue to her.
You don't need me because it would just be 10 minutes of me saying g'day.
There you go.
In repeat, on repeat.
And you've got a radio voice, Alexa.
Yeah, we don't. I don't.
So your name's Goose. Who's I'm Alexa.
And you're?
What are you?
The sidekick.
The lackey.
Have you seen, Top Gun Maverick?
Yeah, I love that movie.
What's your call sign?
I cried in that movie.
Yeah, but what's your call sign?
Of course you did.
Bob.
I'm emotional.
Just Sunny.
Oh, you're not just Sunny.
No, I'm just Sunny.
You're not just...
I'm just Sunny.
You're a ray of sunshine.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Shift Extension Harmony Podcast. I'm Nick. That's Sunny. That's Lou. It's a new day. It's a new episode. I don't know what we're talking about, and that's why we brought Lou on, because she's in charge. She's in control. So, Lou... How are you?
Hello.
What are we doing today?
I'm good. How are you going?
I'm good. What are you doing, Sunny?
Sunny.
Sorry.
It's just for everyone. Doodling.
I did want to mix up my notes. Lou, what are we talking about today?
Today is all about mistakes.
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 Mistakes we've made. Mistakes we're going to make.
Yep.
It's a reasonably fitting topic considering we just delivered the symposium Mistakes, Madness and Mayhem, but you want to focus on mistakes today?
A little bit of perfectionism, perhaps.
Perfectionism.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of can go a bit hand in hand.
Would you say paramedics suffer from a little bit of perfectionism?
Yes, I reckon. Even paramedic students.
What?
Maybe myself.
What?
Yeah.
I'm just going to be the outlier here and say I don't think I've ever struggled with perfectionism.
Because you're just perfect.
I just can't reach that high.
You know you're never going to be good, so you just don't try.
There's zeros, ones and twos, and I'm just going to stick around with the ones.
There's nothing wrong with being just in the middle.
No. If anything, is it safer?
Can you see what happened there, Lou? Nick didn't even try and elevate me above it.
Just dismissed you.
Specifically mistakes. What do you want to know?
Yes. Okay. Have you guys ever made mistakes?
Yes.
Yes.
That's me.
My gosh.
Are we talking about like clinical mistakes?
Clinical.
Mistakes with money.
Emotional mistakes. Relationships. Life.
It's very broad.
You got to be careful here.
Yes, this is probably going to be very, very broad.
You got to, what are we focusing
so,
on?
So I think we talk about clinical mistakes
mm-hmm.
and we maybe lead into a few sort of emotional mistakes.
Nick, I got a pearl I can start with.
Ooh, here we go.
So before we get into it, do you think it's normal to make mistakes? Because I think the people who are listening to this podcast come in thinking that mistakes are a bad thing.
Look, they are. If you are the patient, and they can be if you are the paramedic because they make you feel fairly low.
Are they inevitable?
They're inevitable, and I think they are a part of professional practice, and they are a unfortunate developmental tool to improve clinical development.
Providing you're addressing them, right?
Oh, yes, 100%.
Providing you own them.
It's not the mistake, it's what you do with the mistake that's important.
Yes, and how you deal with it.
Yes.
Absolutely.
We're humans, we make errors. And that's just part of professional practice.
Yes, absolutely.
I wrote a book on about 6 of my mistakes.
Did you?
Just 6 of them. Surely you made more than that.
A lot.
Yeah.
I've got a copy here, we could have a reading session.
Let's not do that.
All right, mistakes. Nick, you're the CCP.
Oh,
everyone looks up to CCPs.
I'm happy to start.
Oh, do you want to start? Sorry. No, Sunny. So I've just dismissed you.
I've got far too many.
Okay.
Well.
CCP.
CCP. Yeah.
Highest clinical authority at this table. Doesn't make mistakes. We call him for assistance.
Yeah.
And I just turn up and
make mistakes.
Set the scene, Nick.
So I think sometimes people think that CCPs are fallible and we're like always really good at our job, but it's just not true. We're humans and we do silly things like what I'm about to tell you about.
Oh, no.
So
have we gone past the statute of limitations for this one?
I will change the information.
Jeff, you're right, mate.
Poor Jeff.
For those unaware, Nick has a human skull on the table that just fell apart.
And his name is Jeff.
It is a learning tool.
It's like a nightmare.
Okay, so let me set the scene. For full disclosure, I will change the information to not identify this patient. So it's...
It was Tuesday last week.
7 p.m.
Mrs. Shelley.
Why is it about my wife?
I'll say it's about your wife. It was a night shift. I was feeling pretty good. I wasn't too fatigued. I hadn't had coffee yet, but it was a night shift. I was working and I went to a patient who was having a STEMI, right? Pretty routine job, really. Been to lots of STEMIs. Lots of STEMIs. And pretty uncomplicated. They were a candidate for a PCR referral. We gave her some drugs. We referred her through to the cardiologist and took her up to hospital. My error was that it turns out when I arrived at that hospital, they didn't know anything about this patient. It was because I had referred them to the wrong hospital.
I expect so much more from you.
Come on, CCP Nick.
So you
pre-notified
the wrong hospital and turned up at a different hospital.
Hold on, no. Sorry. Did you pre-notify the right hospital and turn up at the wrong hospital, or did you pre-notify the wrong hospital and turn up at the right hospital?
Correct.
Right.
Second one. So at 2 a.m. in the morning, I rang an interventional cardiologist and said, I have a patient for you. And he said, fantastic. I'm going to get out of bed, leave my family.
Get my
team. I'm
going
to ring six other people, tell them to do the same thing, and I'm going to go to hospital and do my job. And I'm like, you're my man. I will see you soon. And then I drove to a different hospital. So the thing is, these two hospitals have a very similar name. One is called the first.
We're going to identify it.
We are.
Just
very
similar
names. Yeah. And when you ring them, you go through like a, press one for this hospital, you know, welcome to the PCR line, all that crap. So you press, and I just got the numbers wrong because I was rushing, because I thought I know what the numbers are and I need to press, you know, X, Y, Z.
So you didn't even listen to the options.
Yeah, because you do it so often, right? You go, for this hospital, you press this button, for this hospital, that button. And there's about three steps to
it. I was going to ask what Nick thought was the root cause of this issue, but I mean, he's just spelled it out right there. And then complacency.
Yeah.
Ego.
Yeah, a bit of that going on.
Arrogance.
Yes.
He's a good mate of mine.
You can say that.
It's fine. I'll take it. It's all about reflection, right? So I ring in, it's activated. We turn up. They're like, well, we don't know anything about this STEMI.
Our cardiologist is in bed.
So I ring the right cardiologist. He's like, you didn't ring me, mate. I don't know who you were talking to. I'm like, well, I'm here now. So how do you feel about getting out of bed? He's like, oh, I guess so. So then the worst part was it just dawned on me. I had this disgusting sick feeling in my stomach. I've now had to ring back the other cardiology team and say, hey, I'm not coming.
Did you own the mistake of mixing up hospitals, or did you suggest, hey, you know what? He doesn't have a STEMI.
I did think about going, I'm just going to leave now, put him back in the ambulance and drive him or her or them.
We've narrowed it down to 50% of the population. It's fine.
To the appropriate hospital, but I was like, I'm here now. I've rung. It's fine. But then I had to call the other cardiologist back. So I rang him up. I'm like, hello. No, I rang about to say, hey, I was just honest with him.
Yeah.
You know, there's no point in trying to lie or make up some excuse. You just say, hey, I've made an error. Mm-hmm. I've rung the wrong hospital. I'm not coming. But the start of that conversation was, hey, yeah, thanks. We're all here. We're ready to go. We're scrubbed in. Have you arrived? And I followed up with, I'm not coming.
Oh, no.
And what explained it to him. And then there was this long pause. I'm like, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God.
Oh.
Here is when he takes my soul from me. But he was very professional. He was like, oh, seems fair. Have a good morning. Okay, great. So the patient got up to a cath lab and got their intervention, which was great. And I felt like an absolute fool.
Was the intervention delayed because of your mistake?
Yes.
How far? How long?
Half an hour.
Really? You put an extra 30 minutes on a patient who was dying. Their heart muscle was dying.
Correct.
Wow.
I just want to drive that home. Yeah. You put 30 minutes. What? Time is muscle.
Correct.
Yep. They say.
Yep. Mm. Yep. I was complacent and I rushed things.
Yep.
And I thought, I've done this many times before and it's always gone well.
And can I ask a question?
Yep.
When's the last time that you practiced doing a PCI referral? Because you said you've done it so many times.
That's a good question.
When's the last time you actually rehearsed it?
Oh, years ago.
Because I think that's where sometimes our complacency comes from, is because we're literally not rehearsing what we're actually required to do a lot of the time. There's this notion of, especially in metropolitan areas, that there's, you know, there's enough exposure to things that we're keeping our skills, but we're actually not. Because when you're doing something operationally as opposed to doing something developmentally, you're in two different mindsets. And it's that age-old adage, if you don't take time to sharpen your axe, you're never going to cut down a tree on time. I think there needs to be encouragement and just more space created for paramedics to practice. I mean, look, again, this is one of the reasons why we even talked about creating the shift extension, is because, you know, we recognize that there were so many gaps in the way paramedicine education and paramedicine operations have been delivered over the last 30 years, that there were just gaps that we felt like we could fill. But I find it interesting that some of our highest clinical authorities are just not practicing.
Do you find, as a CCP, you less so practice these things than when you were in, you know?
For the listeners too, CCP, critical care paramedic, across Australia, the definitions change. Yeah. There's ICP, CCP, paramedic, higher clinical skill set.
I think we don't practice as much because we substitute our experience as practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the two should be separated.
Yes.
I think you need to allocate a period of your time to training.
Yeah.
To ensure you get the operations right. But that's a whole nother conversation down the track about, you know, do we invest enough time into training? Mm. But that's a podcast on its own.
Yeah,
given that, you know, across Australia now is national registration, the onus of maintaining skills and abilities is actually back on the paramedic. It's no longer on the private practice or the state service to provide that. So there used to be this culture of, well, if you want me to practice, you've got to pay me to come in and practice. But that's changing. The space is changing, whether people like it or not. Being a nationally registered professional actually puts the onus back on that professional to actually maintain these skills. So we really need to see a shift. But look, I criticized you, Nick. I think it's a great example to kick us off.
Yeah. I think you should share something as well.
Would you believe
that you've never made a mistake in
I've never made a mistake in my career. All right, I'm done. Podcast. Thanks for listening, folks. No, so I've made so many. But one that comes to mind, Nick, is I mean, you literally said a STEMI, and I thought, wow, the last STEMI I managed was a cock-up and a half. And the irony here, Lou, is this is a critical case. And that's why I asked Nick about the time delay in the patient's intervention, because time is muscle. We've only got one heart. We need to preserve as much of that tissue as possible. Before I moved into a metropolitan space, I was quite remote and rural, and I think I had been responsible for 6 or 7 pre-hospital thrombolysis cases, all with varying degrees of success or not success. I think 2 of them ended up arresting on me. The others seemed to resolve fairly as you would expect. But it's also, although I had done 6, I really don't think I had practiced the thrombolysis intervention at all. It was just something that I'd been trained to do and then I was expected to do, and I did whenever it came up. But when I moved into a metropolitan arena, I remember going to a STEMI and being very blasé about it, because there were so many additional steps in a thrombolysis case, there were so many more risks in a thrombolysis case, as opposed to something as simple and as easy as PCI referral. So PCI referral is, what is it, Nick, like 2 tablets these days?
2 tablets. Some heparin.
GTN.
And talking to a cardiologist and then transporting them there, where you can then sit on the other side of a glass window and watch someone essentially have the intervention performed. Like it's incredibly simple. But so I had a STEMI, and I actually had a recent graduate with me. She was awesome. I mean, she was smarter than me. I think we need to be educating our students and graduates to be better than us, at least in knowledge, so that the experience can transcend anything we've done. But she was a very, very clever lass, and she was very, very excited about going to her first STEMI. So there's me basically cruising in my B-roll, Mr. Cool. Oh, I've managed heaps of these. We get there, and it's classic STEMI. It just, you couldn't have more of a just easy presentation. We spoke in an earlier podcast this year about provisional diagnosis. I didn't need any. This was a STEMI, clear cut. Oh, it's dangerous. But that's not where the error happened. The error actually happened in the space of, I said to the girl I was working with, well, if you want to take the case, you can. She was excited, so she started going down the technical routes of things. And I had to do BLS, basic life support. Let's get an ECG on. Let's get some GTN in. Let's get some aspirin in. So I got the ECG and I got the GTN in, and then I got the aspirin in. And after I delivered the aspirin, my partner turned to me and she said, Sonny, that's paracetamol. I looked at this patient who was chewing just this powdery, disgusting, acidic mess of paracetamol. Like you said, well, I mean, he's in pain. It's not like we're not indicated for paracetamol.
It's true. Right?
But then after he had managed to ingest his paracetamol, then like, here's another tablet. It's aspirin. I was mortified. Not only was this poor patient dying in front of me, I then gave him the most disgusting thing to chew up in the history of mankind. That's also not going to help the situation at all. We corrected the mistake, and we actually transported to through the PCR referral with success. But this girl I was working with too was actually gobsmacked when we're in the hospital bay, and I rang a clinical support officer to say, hey, I've got a case you need to review and audit. And I rang him. He's a colleague of mine. And I basically said, look, we're just at a STEMI. I gave the patient paracetamol instead of aspirin. I had, you know, some gilded laughter on the other end of the phone. And then we were advised to go see the CSO. And on the way there, she'd said to me, why did you dob yourself in? I was the only person who knew. No one would have ever known. And I found that, I guess, somewhat alarming or somewhat concerning, because when I was a student, I got to work with someone. I'm going to call him out because he's a legend, Mark Ward.
Mark Ward.
Mark Ward. Shout out to Mark Ward. I'm sure he was the only true mentor I ever had when I was a student. And he taught me the value of owning mistakes early and using them as a developmental tool. He said, never will they be used as a weapon against you. You need to use them and let other people learn from them. So, you know, I spoke to this girl on the way there, and, you know, I suggested that although no one else would have known, we wouldn't develop ourselves unless we did identify it. But the culture around mistakes is still somewhat alarming. I mean, Lou, even when you had suggested, hey, let's talk about mistakes in this podcast, you even said, oh, I don't want to put you guys in an awkward spot. Are you prepared to share them? And Nick said, I'm more than happy to share them. But, I mean, part of what we do is taking a different approach and hopefully normalizing some of these discussions, because that could have been a catastrophic mistake if she didn't identify that.
Absolutely.
This patient never would have had aspirin, you know, in that, yep, that algorithm, which it's hard to say either here or there whether that could have dastardly affected them. But if we don't get comfortable owning mistakes, we're going to continue to make them. If we don't get comfortable owning mistakes, no one's going to develop, us included. And if we're never going to own mistakes, the profession will never develop. So I got a question for you, Lou. You heard Nick through, I said yours was complacency, ego, and arrogance. Nick, what made me make my mistakes?
Complacency, ego, and arrogance.
With capital letters.
Well, it's just a process. And I think we have processes because they create safety. And sometimes we take those processes, advantage of those processes, and we become complacent because we don't value them as being critical to ensuring safety. So it's something like a drug check, right? A drug check is there for patient safety to ensure it. But if...
When did you learn drug checks, Lou? What year?
Year one.
And exactly. I didn't do it.
Yeah.
As a qualified experienced paramedic.
But why didn't you
do it?
Ego, arrogance, complacency.
Because you didn't value it as a safety tool, because you haven't, it hasn't gone wrong before.
It hasn't gone wrong before that I've identified, so yeah, exactly. Clearly.
And how many drug errors do we make?
Do you look at me like a lesser paramedic having known that I made a basic yet serious mistake?
No.
Why?
It's what you did after you made that mistake. you identified it, and you had a student with you, was that right? Or a junior clinician?
Yeah, junior clinician.
Yeah. So you not only owned your mistake, but you helped with her own development by...
We actually had both. I had a junior clinician as my partner, and we had a student ride along.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. You identified
it. Supervisor.
And addressed it. Good on you.
But would that, I mean, from their perspective, you know, I mean, they expect perfectionism. They expect the very best. They want to be mentored and supported by the best. And then they see their qualified making a catastrophic error.
Is it that my question is, should we be changing their expectations? The way that they look at you. So was that really good in their development in that they saw you make a mistake, they saw you address it, own up to it, you know, admit that you had given the wrong medication. So you've helped.
I was indicated. They're in pain.
I mean.
You've provided pain relief to your patient.
That's true. No,
sorry, it's not funny.
Paracetamol is a great adjunct to narcotics.
Not when you chew it up.
Not when you chew it. And it, if it was the home brand one, the terrible Panamax or whatever.
It made his lips all dry and his tongue dry. Like, he's already dying. What about Nick's example? I mean, that's in front of qualified paramedics who are calling for additional support.
Mm.
That's in front of people who are both above and below him.
And your question was, does it change the way that I see Nick? Was that the question? Sorry, I've forgotten what you asked.
Essentially.
Yeah, absolutely not. Because
I think he's been kind.
Owned it. Well.
Be honest.
Let's talk about the rest of the profession then when people make mistakes.
Well, it's the way you deal with it, though, isn't it? Are we, at the end of the day, robots? Are we programmed to
What's the difference between a human and a robot? I mean, apart from the obvious. I would say vulnerability.
Yeah. The emotional factors that come into it. You know, that what I mentioned before, that hungry, angry, late, tired, stressed, the bias.
Oh, yeah, I want to use that.
The ego, the complacency. Do robots have that inbuilt into them? I mean, we could, but.
Let's go back a step. Do you think mistakes are inevitable?
Yes.
Are you taught that mistakes are inevitable? No. Are you taught that mistakes are unacceptable?
Not just at uni, even out in the professional space. I mean, you've been on placement. We've both been working. I don't think mistakes are actually accepted enough.
Do you think we can control all the variables within our space?
Absolutely not. That's the nature of the beast, right?
Because I feel that sometimes when things don't go well, or people, their perception of a case is that things didn't go well. They have this self-critical perspective of themselves and of the team and of the case. They go, well, this didn't happen. I should have done this better and this took a while and I took me ages to put the LMA in or I got distracted by something or I didn't ask that question. And they are very self-critical because of those things happening. But I wonder, if those things are inevitable, why are we being so self-critical? Like, if we work in an environment where, for example, in our training, right, and I don't want to harp on about training is the way it is because it is partly there to educate you, but it's also they need to have a level of assessment and a matrix for which to assess you against to be able to give you a piece of paper. There are plenty of variables that happen in the real world that we can't control. For example, if someone is having a STEMI, they might respond to lysis, they may not. They might respond to GTN, they may not. They might arrest and die, or they might survive and get better. The cannula might work, the cannula might not work. I might drop the drug correctly, I might spill it and stab myself. There's plenty of things that can or may not happen that I have no control over. And I think sometimes we think that we have control of these things when really we don't.
I feel like all those examples was Nick just describing his career.
Well, it's true, right? Because you're thinking about it. When you do a lot of our training is I turn up, I find a problem, I do intervention, patient gets better, crisp high five, see you later. How many categories scenarios have you done in your training, Sonny, in the last 12 years where the patient just died?
In my career, none.
Or the cannula didn't work the first time.
It's never been given to me, a patient dying in cardiac arrest, and yet how many have I had on the street?
So many. Or the suction not working, or the oxygen running out halfway through. If we train in a perfectionism mindset that things happen perfectly all the time and that's the standard that we should reach, then no wonder we have this self-critical perception of ourselves.
You know, Nick, I was part of a what I would call a major clinical error a couple of years ago. And it was an amazing how quickly the person I was working with laid blame to me. Really quickly, it was a seizing patient. We were distracted by a second patient. It was all in a car park. Second patient with uncontrolled AF that I was distracted with when the person I was working with allegedly gave midazolam to the seizing patient outside. And when I came out to assist, there was a clearly labeled midazolam syringe on the ground and an unlabeled syringe that had been used. And so I can only, from that information, I can only assume that instead of being given midazolam, the patient was given a saline flush because the patient was still seizing. And we identified the issue quickly. I discarded the midazolam in case that had been labeled incorrectly. There's obviously a clinical error had happened, and then we drew up a new dose of midazolam and gave it, and actually had a really good effect, which again would give emphasis to the fact that there was an error made initially. But after we did the handover at the hospital and we were separated for an interview, I wasn't quick to lay blame to anyone. I just said we. It was us. But it was quickly identified that the person I'd been working with was putting all of the blame onto me. And I hadn't even been the one to push the drug, and it floored me that someone could so callously throw a colleague under the bus, so to speak. But it also, it made me, I guess, really try and unpack how we would even be in that situation, how we've developed a culture of practice that would make that more acceptable than just owning a mistake. The irony, though, was, and this makes, you know what, thanks for the topic, Lou. This makes me sound like a very incompetent person. But I'd actually made a clinical error by myself some months earlier. And I had self-identified it to the clinical educators. So back then I went through not a performance improvement plan, but just a developmental plan just to assist me through the mistake that I'd self-identified. But because I had done that, the question was raised immediately, why would I self-identify an issue I had made by myself when no one could see it and then try and hide something when someone else could see it? And interestingly, because of that incident showing, I guess, my ethos or my character, the investigation quickly focused on the other person. If Sonny had identified this when he's by himself and could have hidden it, why on earth would he do that now? We're not convinced that makes sense. Then also take into account, Sonny has not blamed anyone. He keeps saying we, whereas this other person had blamed me exponentially. And so, I mean, that was a massive lesson for me, not just in, you know, using mistakes as a developmental tool, but also your reputation, your character, your ethos is worth so much more than being perfect. If you make yourself vulnerable, at least you're human. And then in things like integrity and honesty will shine. And I'm not saying I'm perfect even in that respect, but it's just that was a massive lesson for me, even as a, you know, mid-30s experienced paramedic. Wow, that literally just saved me from this. Yeah. You know.
So would you say then that perfectionism and mistakes can kind of go hand in hand in that it's people who are perfectionists struggle to own their own mistakes? Or they?
It's a difficult thing because There's some very high achieving paramedics, as in your cohort, there'd be some very high achieving students. I had a student that I had to fail a couple of years ago, and she was devastated, right? And I got it. I didn't even necessarily agree with the process that was being used, but at the same time, we're all bound by, you know, policy and procedure or wherever we work. But she was devastated, but I spoke to her after she'd calmed down and, you know, gone through those stages of grief to more acceptance. And I explained to her that, I mean, I've got a sick daughter. If I had a paramedic coming down the steps to look after my daughter who has never made a mistake, I would be more nervous than if I had a paramedic coming down the steps who has made five or six mistakes, who's failed a subject and had to repeat, because they've had to go through a different process of learning. I think there's so much less resilience in people who are perceived to be perfectionists or perfect, because those are the people who either have never failed yet, or they have and they've hidden it to maintain. So I think there's far more resilience, there's far more character, and there's far more ability in those people who are not perfect, who those people who are vulnerable, in those people who have made mistakes.
Yeah.
But we're getting way too deep here, Nick. I want to hear
very deep.
I want to hear about another one of your mistakes, yeah. Mr. Perfect. I've got too many.
I want to explore this idea of perfectionism because I think perfectionism is probably more prevalent in our.
Fine. We'll explore that after you tell me about another mistake.
All right, another mistake.
More. Just one more. Give us one.
Okay. Okay. Oh, here's a good one. Many moons ago. Many, many moons. I was like 22 at the time.
Okay. Too much information.
Okay.
Just say you were young.
I was young.
Can you identify this?
No. So I went to a patient in a nursing home that had a very distressed, a lot of pain. It turns out she was having a significant intracranial bleed. And she was in her 90s. And we gave her some pain relief. And we'd given her some intramuscular pain relief because we couldn't get any IV access. I was working with a student at the time, and they were quite new to the role, and they were like, "This, I don't know anything about narcotics. I don't know anything about access. I'll just do what you tell me to do because you're the boss." So we gave this lady some intramuscular pain relief. Her blood pressure was through the roof. She was very distressed, and that made me stressed that I could get access on her and I couldn't settle her pain. I didn't know what was going on. And we got to that point, that 5-10 minute point after the initial administration, and it's time for some more pain relief because she's still in lots of pain. So we got another 10 milligrams of narcotics into her. And at the time, that was too much. It was
Lou,
outside
I love where this is going.
Protocol.
I love it.
Anyway, so we loaded her up, and she became a little sleepy. And after the fact, realized that we had given her too much narcotics. Now, the challenge with that case was a day or two later, my supervisor called me into their office and said, "Hey, Nick, that patient that you gave too much narcotics to, she's died." And my mind immediately went to, "I've killed someone."
It's not a very supportive way to approach a subject with a employee. But anyway, that's a different discussion.
I'd been a paramedic for maybe 12 months. I'm like, I'm 22 and I've just done my first murder. But she died from her catastrophic subarachnoid bleed, not the morphine. If anything, the morphine probably
made her more comfortable.
But at the time, it was a drug error and we had stepped outside, potentially causing her to have a complication. And it was because of my complacency and me being stressed and not following a process. And I was devastated. I was devastated that I had let myself, who I had held myself to a high standard, for that to happen. And it went through the process. But at the end of the process, a very senior person in the organization that I look up to and have a lot of respect for said to me, "It's like, these things happen. You've reflected on it. That's what we want. We don't necessarily care as much about the mistake. It's what you do with the mistake and how you process it and what learning you can come from it, because the mistake is inevitable. It's going to happen. We can put safety systems in place to reduce the likelihood of mistakes. And as we get more mistakes and we have more lessons, we'll get better systems, but they're going to happen. It's about what you do with it. The issue is when people make excuses and they put blame on other people and they say, it's not my fault. That's a problem because that's showing someone that isn't willing to grow. And that's someone who's dangerous and unsafe to be a clinician. But if you reflect, then it's not an issue." And that person in the organization was like, "It happens. We'll see you on the CCP program in a few years' time." And that to me was like, oh, huge, because I felt like I wasn't a retarded clinician anymore. But yeah, that was my last.
Use that then to segue into unpacking perfectionism.
Perfectionism. Well, Lou, we talked about perfectionism on the phone the other day. I want to hear your perspectives before I unpack mine.
It's a big issue.
They do this when they want to cut me out of a conversation.
Sorry, Simon.
And I understand. It's fine.
Is it an issue for you, or do you think it's an issue across the student cohort?
I believe it's an
issue. Across the profession.
Yeah, across the profession. Across the profession. And okay. I feel like it starts in the university environment and it just progresses.
Why is it perpetuated at the very beginning then?
It's a really good question.
Do you think it's like Do you think it's this is the standard, this is how it needs to be?
Yeah.
If you make errors, you're done?
Yeah.
It's the translation of the professional culture to the next generation. This is why I say rather than the student cohort, let's talk about the profession because it's the profession who's guiding the students.
Yeah, it's true.
It's the profession who's guiding the graduates.
Is it because they don't speak to their own mistakes, these, you know, like our educators?
You know, interestingly, I mean, I've worked with a lot of paramedic educators over my career, both in services and in academia, and I'm always amused by something, and I'm going to sound really cheeky here, but I'm always amused by the people who will continue to promote this ideal that I was an intensive care paramedic for 40 years. That's how they elevate themselves. Well, that kind of statement is how they elevate themselves above the students, and it gives them status.
Hierarchical.
And the reason why I'm amused by that, Lou, is because so many of these people who I have worked with who hold these titles, you know, I've been a flight paramedic for 12 years, they actually haven't practiced in that role for nearly a decade or 5 years or 2 years because they've been working in academia. And it seems like there's almost a lack of emotional maturity in the profession in that people – we get status as being paramedic. We get status for being flight paramedics. We get status for, you know, the hierarchical influence of having a crown on your shoulder, whatever it is. But there's not enough emotional intelligence for people to accept that if I'm no longer doing that role, I need to be doing something else in the profession. And so I think that's where the translation occurs is so many of the educators, and look, I'm speaking broadly here from my own biased perspective, but certainly people I've worked with, so many educators and so many of the, this is in quotation marks, mentors, have got to hold themselves above people. And they've never considered what's going to happen when the trainee or the student or the graduate or the person who's under them surpasses them. We should be promoting a culture that actually not just encourages people to surpass their mentor, but celebrates it. The students who I've put through, some of them are already clinically above me. Some of them are already operationally above me. Some of them have gone so far already that all I can do is smile because that's what we're supposed to do. You don't need to hold on to this notion of this is what I used to do. Otherwise, I would still be telling people that I was a recon soldier or I was a combat medic. And, you know, I mean, that was two lifetimes ago. I was even fortunate to fly for 2 years. That doesn't mean I'm doing it now. I actually haven't flown in a helicopter or plane in 5, 6, 7 years. So if people ask me what I do, I say I'm a paramedic because that's what I am. But I think the profession itself struggles a little bit at the moment with actually acting professionally. There's going to be some people hating on me or hating on the podcast. I'm sorry.
Just lost some followers on Instagram.
Damn it!
Look, I've even struggled with it myself sometimes. And this is, again, where bias comes in. When people whose values I don't appreciate or don't like who are below me, who surpass me, you know. But at the same time, I mean, this is the Jedi Padawan mentality. You know, they knew about it back in the 80s with Jedis. Why are we still learning this now?
So we need to go and watch Star Wars.
Look, I get a lot of my philosophical approaches from Marvel, DC, and Lucasfilms.
Okay, so great. So why do you think this is an issue in the student cohort, Lou, or for you?
Ooh, it feels like it's a very competitive environment, and I know a lot of my peers are always, you know, wanting to know what others got on their assessments or whatever it may be, and it feels, what was that?
I think that was the cat.
Or the snake in the roof.
Probably.
No, the cat's there.
Oh, might be the snake in the roof.
See ya.
Seriously, I think there's a snake in the roof.
Outstanding.
You want to have a look?
I'll have a look.
I know.
Go on.
Oh, my goodness. Competitive.
Competitive. I think it comes down to we're all very competitive, and depending on what job we're all chasing, we know that there are limited spots to get into certain careers relating to paramedicine as well. So we've already got that in the back of our mind, and we are performing in front of our peers as well when we get up and we do simulation. So it's all on display for everyone to see. So wouldn't you want to be perfect and wouldn't you want to do well?
There's no real difference there to performing in front of the public.
Yeah.
As a qualified. And that's why I say it's more of a professional issue than just a, you know, student issue. I think mistakes need to be accepted. I don't want to use the word celebrated, but they certainly need to be used.
As a guide for learning.
We've talked about what FAIL stands for.
Have we?
It's my favourite thing.
What does it stand for?
Educate me.
First attempt in learning.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. Oh, I like it.
You like that?
I had fine in my head when you say, how are you? And people say fine. It stands for freaked out, insecure, neurotic and emotional.
Well.
Which isn't most of the time.
That's how I am after I make a mistake.
First attempt in learning. Oh, I like that, Lou.
How good's that?
Yeah. Unfortunately for students, it means repeating a year.
Yes.
Unfortunately for paramedics, it means ridicule from colleagues and...
It's a bit like scenarios, right? I think sometimes people don't want to do scenarios because they see it as a performance that's going to be critiqued. But really a scenario or any form of training is an opportunity for you to identify gaps in your practice so you can create learnings for yourself. So if you go and do a scenario on a day or even going and looking after patients on a shift for a day, it's an amazing opportunity for you to be better than you were when you woke up, either through you've practiced a skill, you have new understandings of your knowledge, you formulated new questions to guide your study, you have new insights about how you think.
Absorb something from, is that your fridge?
Yeah, it does that, mate.
Even absorbing things from someone else, and this is why I think it's really important to share the mistakes, identify and share, because you can, you know, a mistake I made years ago. This is ironic, Nick, because you first said STEMI and I said, oh, I balls up a STEMI too. You then said pain relief. I've also balls up a pain relief, but mine was working by myself, heavily fatigued. Fatigue is a whole nother issue. Intractable pain from sciatica. I gave this female patient 5 milligrams of morphine. It did nothing. She was howling. It was hurting my head. I gave her another 5. She was howling now. This wasn't outside of our scope at the time or the place I was at. I went out, prepared the stretcher, did a couple other things, came in. She was still howling. I gave her another 5 milligrams of morphine, right? And she was a large patient, and it was doing nothing to even touch the pain. And it was at that moment I realized the venous tourniquet was still on. And in my head was, leave it on, click.
Oh, God.
And she did exactly what you'd expect. Eyes rolled in the back of her head, and she basically collapsed. And I kind of looked at her, and I'm like, well, shit. Things have escalated. At least I'm by myself. Fuck, why am I by myself? Right. And I went through a quick ABC. As you would expect, she was severely respiratory depressed. So I started ventilating her, got onto dispatch and asked for some urgent backup because my patient had deteriorated because I touched her. Long story short, when I was reviewing that case with a clinical educator, and he was a cranky bastard. He said to me, what would you do different next time? And I'm like, I honestly don't know what I would do differently, right? I was tired. I just didn't notice it. He said, well, if you noticed that we've compartmentalized where this morphine is sitting, what can you strategize to try and perform at least a slow release? I said, I've no idea. He said, well, something I learned from a similar mistake years ago is put on a manual blood pressure cuff, inflate it to the point it will prevent any leakage, and then slowly release that cuff over the next 10, 20 minutes. He said, it's not perfect medicine, but at least we're going to control the release. And if I hadn't shared that mistake, if I hadn't identified that mistake, I never would have learned how to actually manage that situation. Now, the irony is I've never made that mistake again, so I'm still waiting to use that intervention.
That's a great intervention.
15 years later, but I've shared that story enough times with enough people that maybe someone else has. And I think that...
Thank you for sharing that.
Well,
keep that in the back of my mind.
Look, Lou, it's not my geniusness, is it? It's actually my stupidity. It's someone else's genius.
But you learned from it.
But I learned from it. And because I've learned from it, hundreds of other people have heard that story and hopefully have as well. I mean, would you manage that any other way?
I'd probably go, oh, whoops, click. And go, got some naloxone. Have a little bit of that. There you go. Miss Goosey, how's your pain? Better? Great. No, it's true. And that's why, like, I'm a big advocate for training. And, you know, I'd love to do more training. It just doesn't happen. But the great thing about training is it's designed for you to make mistakes, right? And I think this is the problem with how we set up training now is that it's like, oh, you met a drugger, you're bad, or you didn't do this, you didn't do that, it's unsafe, or you failed.
Lose your registration.
Lose your registration. No, mistakes should happen in training because if you walk into a training room, the same way you're going to walk into a patient. So if you've made mistakes in a training room, that's good because we've captured them instead of you doing it to a real person, right? So we should be putting you in front of a plastic mannequin on the ground as much as possible because so you can make those mistakes in a safe place. Mm-hmm. I did a scenario years ago. It was leading up to something called Trauma Week. Trauma Week is a week in for critical care paramedic interns where they do some really high fidelity training, and it's the best scenario training you'll ever do in your career. It's so good. They put a lot of money into it. It's great, but it's had a reputation for being quite robust, a robust week. Anyway, so I did the scenario, and it was a trauma patient. They had a lot of chest injuries and a lot of other problems, and this patient just had a pneumothorax that was tensioning. And I was like, oh, it must be an airway problem. So I did a surgical airway instead of decompressing their chest. But you know what? I did it to a mannequin, not a real person. And that experience had a profound learning for me.
Is that on video? Can I access
We'd like to see that.
I think I actually feel better.
Mostly for the professional ridicule.
But at the same time, perfectionism was a huge issue for me. I was doing a program where I thought I had to be perfect all the time and on all the time, and everything had to be up to scratch. And then when I made mistakes, I fell hard, and it was a big issue. And I had to spend a lot of time reflecting and getting into my head that the mistakes were okay, and you have to make the mistakes. And I would say to people who are out there and they feel like everything needs to be perfect all the time, it is not achievable. It's not going to happen in our world. We don't have control of all the variables. You're going to make mistakes and you're going to feel shit about them, but just sit in that uncomfortable feeling and go, yep, this was going to happen. It's inevitable.
Pride comes before a fall.
Yep.
Lou, that was your topic. What are your takeaways?
Yeah. I think that breaking it down to why we make mistakes, but what we do with those mistakes is really, really important. It's important for students, but it's also important for practicing clinicians to address those mistakes and learn from them and grow. And maybe, you know, do a bit of self-reflection and go, am I a perfectionist? And is this dangerous that I am a perfectionist? Do I need to lower my standards a little bit? Or, you know, be aware of the type of person that I am would be my take-home points.
We've got to aim high. But yeah, we've still got to accept absolutely. That we're human.
We are not robots at the end of the day. Not yet. Come on, Elon. You can do it.
Come on, mate.
Come on. And talking about mistakes with your peers, I think is really important as well.
Let's encourage more people to have the conversation.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
If someone approaches you about a mistake, just go to into it with some understanding and some kindness rather than from ridicule and judgment.
Absolutely. Yep.
Crazy. I think that's all we have time for today. Great conversation. Thanks for joining us. If you have any questions, qualms, queries, or concerns, you can reach out to us. We are on Facebook, Instagram. You can find us online at www.theshiftextension.org and send us a message or an email. But until next time, see you later.